It's 2:40 Central Time. In sports, DePaul plays its first game under interim coach Tracy Webster tonight. The Blue Demons host Providence in a Big East Conference matchup. Also on the college hardwood tonight, the University of Illinois women are in Columbus, Ohio to take on the Buckeyes. The Chicago Bulls have a string of road games coming up. They play 10 of their next 12 away from the United Center beginning tonight in Boston. The Celtics started the season fast but have been hit by a series of injuries to key players in the past couple of weeks, and they have lost 5 of their last 9 games. And the Chicago Blackhawks play the Columbus Blue Jackets tonight before heading out on an 8-game road trip, their longest of the season. Injured winger Marian Hossa may return to the Blackhawks lineup tonight. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy the Moscow Festival Ballet's Coppelia, January 19th through 21st. More information can be found at KrannertCenter.com.
After the attempted airline bombing on Christmas Day, President Obama is promising big changes.
More baggage screening, more passenger screening, and more advanced explosive detection capabilities, including those that can improve our ability to detect the kind of explosive used on Christmas.
The president wants to equip airports with hundreds of full body scanners that look for bombs and weapons. These scanners use X-rays, although the devices are not like the X-ray machines you think you know. NPR's John Hamilton reports on the advantages and disadvantages of the new equipment.
Medical X-rays are powerful enough to pass all the way through your body. Stephen Smith, an electrical engineer, says the airport machines rely on a much weaker beam.
The X-rays you're using typically penetrate through your clothing and about an eighth to a quarter of an inch into your body, where they ricochet or backscatter back in the same direction they came from.
To a sort of camera that captures a digital image. Smith designed one of the first of these so-called backscatter scanners 20 years ago. These days he runs Spectrum San Diego, an electronic imaging company. Smith says backscatter X-rays are safe because they require only an insignificant amount of radiation. But he says the images they produce can look a lot like a nude photograph.
It shows everything under your clothing, and if you had something within a few millimeters of your skin surface, it would show that also.
The government plans to use software that makes the images less graphic. Prisons have been using the backscatter technology for many years to find knives, guns, and contraband, even though the machines cost more than $150,000 apiece. More recently, the U.S. military has deployed the scanners in Iraq to protect bases there from terrorists.
In general, body scanners are able to give you the same degree of detection capability as frisking someone would, but it is far less invasive than actually frisking someone.
Smith, who is a former police officer, says he doesn't want to talk about what the scanners might not find. He says that could help terrorists. Other experts, though, say backscatter scanners would probably miss a weapon or explosive concealed in a body cavity. And that apparent weakness has provided an opportunity for a company in Indiana called Nesh LLC. It's developing another low-dose X-ray device that can find contraband where other scanners can't. This machine is called Dexy. Ivan Nesh is the company's CEO.
To my knowledge, it's the only one that very reliably can detect the presence of such substances, explosives or illegal substances, that are hidden inside of a human body.
So can any of this X-ray tech really make air travel safer?
Of course not. It's sort of magical thinking.
Bruce Schneier is a security consultant who sees a couple of big problems with the government's strategy. First, he says every technology has its limits, and he's not reassured by the government's new scanner.
It doesn't detect low-density explosives. It doesn't detect explosives that are thin. You know, it's really very limited as to what it detects. It might or might not have detected the underwear bomber. No, we don't actually know.
Schneier says another problem is that even hundreds of scanners won't be enough to protect every airport.
If you remember, the 9/11 terrorists didn't go through security in Boston. They went through security in places like Maine. Because once you're through security anywhere in the system, you're never screened again. So unless these machines are in every airport in the country, all we're doing is making the terrorists, you know, take another flight before they launch their attack.
Schneier says the government's real problem isn't a lack of technology. It's a strategy that reacts to what has already happened, not what might happen next time.
Airports are the last line of defense, and they're not a very good one. And reinforcing that line of defense really has very minimal a return for security.
He says taxpayers would get more for their money if the government invested less in hardware and more in investigations of potential terrorists and better intelligence. John Hamilton, NPR News.
When it comes to global warming, America is in a bind. Almost half of our electricity comes from coal, but compared to other power sources, coal produces the most carbon dioxide, a greenhouse gas. Industry is testing so-called clean coal technology to deal with the problem. Sean Ali has this update on a test project that has some hard work left to do.
If you live outside coal mining country, you may have missed this news about a clean coal project in West Virginia.
Big announcement has the state and members of the coal industry very excited about the future of the state's most valuable resource.
The fanfare in this report from Clarksburg's WBOY is about a company called American Electric Power. Last fall, AEP started a test that some see as a clean coal revolution.
Coal technology. The Mountaineer Power Plant in Mason County is going to be the first facility in the world to use carbon capture and sequestration technology to cut down on the levels of carbon dioxide that plant emits.
The Mountaineer test project made headlines because there's talk of clamping down on America's carbon dioxide emissions. Coal produces nearly twice its own weight in carbon dioxide. So if we could bury or sequester the stuff, that would help solve the coal industry's carbon dioxide problem. Now, the expectations are high, but the company is keeping its cool.
The tension we're fighting against is the fact that you can't go from concepts on paper all the way to commercial scale in one step.
Gary Spitznagel runs an engineering division for AEP, and if you think he sounds cautious, it's because he is. Spitznagel says AEP needs to validate carbon capture and sequestration.
Validation is it's kind of that intermediate step between what is truly research work and full commercial scale.
Validation is just another way of saying this technology mostly works, but let's take it for a spin. Let's run bigger and bigger tests so we learn more and more.
The test is treating the amount of gas that would come from a 20-megawatt power generating unit, so that's very small.
From 20 megawatts now to 250 megawatts in a few years, that's still less than a quarter of the power generation at the Mountaineer plant. But really, what's the point of all the tests like this? The thing is, there's a problem with carbon capture and sequestration, and that is it wastes coal. This waste is called parasitic load. That's parasitic, as in parasite.
And because it's taking the power that it's consuming from the generating plant that you're controlling, it's a parasite to that power plant.
It sounds so nefarious.
Well, and the reason it's such a focus is that it's no matter what technology you look at, the number is large.
Carbon capture and sequestration equipment needs power. That adds a parasitic load of 30% onto a coal plant. Now, that means it takes 30% more coal to generate the same amount of electricity for customers. Spitznagel needs to find out if his technology cuts that parasitic load figure. Other people hope he finds out, too.
The overarching concern that I would have today is urgency.
Ernest Moniz runs MIT's Energy Initiative. He says if power companies don't get a handle on parasitic load, we are in for higher utility bills. One estimate puts the cost of clean coal power at 70% above today's prices. Moniz says we need bigger tests and more of them.
We are pushing up against the envelope, and we have to do it. If we are going to be serious about, you know, using our extensive coal reserves in a time of carbon constraints, well, then we just have to demonstrate this technology.
If we fail to demonstrate clean coal technology, the choices are not good. We'd either have to abandon our cheap coal supplies, or we'd keep burning dirty coal. Then we'd have to deal with the costs of global climate change. Talk about parasitic load. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Ali.
The word bling does not begin to describe the dazzle on display right now at San Francisco's Legion of Honor Museum. The exhibition is called Cartier in America, and it has precious pieces the French jeweler made over the years for this country's rich and famous. Here's NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg.
Come, let's mix where Rockefellers walk with sticks or umbrellas in their mitts.
During the Great Depression, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers gave adoring moviegoers a look at the deluxe.
Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper.
trying hard to look like Gary Cooper. Super duper.
These dreary economic days, crowds are flocking to the Cartier show in San Francisco. In tough economic times, people need fantasy, even if they can't pronounce it.
Do you say brooch or brooch?
A brooch.
Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Curator Martin Chapman is looking at a potato-sized pin that belonged to Marjorie Merriweather Post, the Post cereal heiress. You know, Postum, Grape Nuts, Post Toasties. At Hillwood, her estate in Washington, D.C., there's a portrait of her wearing this brooch, an 8-inch-long cascade of diamond and green glitter.
And some people said she must have had a shoulder strap made of iron to hold this up, because it's an enormous object made of 7 carved Indian emeralds.
A talented shopper, Marjorie Merriweather Post was one of dozens of privileged Americans with big bank accounts and royal tastes who carried out an age-old custom of power adornment.
There is an ancient tradition in Europe that, or the rulers, the princes of Europe, went into battle wearing all their best jewelry to act as a flag for their troops, but also as a way to buy themselves out of difficulties should they fall into enemy hands.
Cartier made its reputation in the 1890s, so ancient princes went elsewhere for their battle gear. But Gilded Age Americans, Vanderbilts, Morgans, Astors, Goulds, got lots of their gilding from the French jeweler. In a 1909 photo, Mrs. Cornelius Vanderbilt sports a tiara, necklace, bracelet.
But the real concentration is at the bosom, where she has a very large breast ornament, which is made of fringed diamonds ending in tassels, and in the middle is a very large diamond rose, which she bought from Cartier in 1904.
A few years earlier, for his coronation, Queen Victoria's luxury-loving son Edward had named Cartier his royal jeweler. Some of the tiaras fashioned for Edward VII's coronation are in the San Francisco show. Diamonds, platinum. Nice. In that same period, the jewelry Cartier made for Americans was often more elaborate, blingier, than what was made for British and European royals. As time went by, American tastes streamlined some. Al Jolson, Grace Kelly, her engagement ring seen here for the first time, Elizabeth Taylor, Barbara Streisand were all clients. So was an American divorcee who notoriously married into royalty.
Exquisite.
Absolutely
I've never seen
fabulous.
In real life. Yeah. Seen many pictures of it, but never in real life.
Yes, it's unbelievable.
The museum goers are admiring a pin made for Wallis Simpson, the Duchess of Windsor. The Duke brought in a necklace and 4 gemstone bracelets and asked Cartier to take them all apart and reconfigure them.
There's an important sense of recycling at that point. And with those pieces, Cartier came up with this extraordinary fantasy object, a clip brooch, as it's called, in the form of a flamingo, with its plumage bristling with rubies and sapphires and emeralds. Not naturalistic colouring at all.
It's got to be 3 inches tall, and the body, the neck, and the beginning of the back, and the legs, the skinny little legs are diamonds. But as you say, the rest are not.
Yes, absolutely.
The pin was made in Paris in May 1940, a month before the German invasion. The Windsors fled France and took the flamingo with them. The British branch of the jewelry store got involved politically during World War II.
Cartier London was the center of the Free French. They gave the upper floors to General de Gaulle. So Cartier was very patriotic during the war.
The Paris store remained open throughout the war and kept producing objects despite drastic shortages of luxury materials and money. They fashioned a golden cage which enclosed a tiny bird.
It's made out of a very small amount of gold with coral, lapis wings, and a diamond-set head.
The pin was a subversive message from Cartier in protest against the Nazi occupation. In 1947, the jeweler made another bird and cage.
But in this case, the golden cage The doors are open, yes?
Yes.
And what you see is the bird emerging from it.
Yes, that's the idea, is the joy of France emerging from the occupation of the Nazis.
Bejeweled and costly stories of trials and triumphs, the exhibition Cartier and America is on view at the Legion of Honor Museum in San Francisco until the middle of April. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Earth and Sky.
You can see the kind of confused look of the seal as they're looking up at this strange little object. You can see their eyes.
You're listening to Betsy Weatherhead. She's describing the view from an unmanned aircraft, only 1 or 2 meters in wingspan, as it flies over the Arctic to monitor wildlife.
There's something that you could have in your garage and take out and play with if you really wanted to. We send them out over the Arctic Ocean for long distances, often 500 miles or more, taking measurements low over the ocean, trying to understand what's out there, because we don't send manned aircraft out there.
Weatherhead is a senior research scientist at the University of Colorado Boulder. She spoke to us at a science meeting in late 2009. She said it can be very dangerous to send human pilots into polar conditions. So scientists control these aircraft from the ground, gathering important data from scientific instruments and cameras loaded on board.
Sea ice has been changing dramatically in the Arctic over the last couple of years. The mammals are affected by that, the polar bear, the ice seals, the walruses, and we don't know exactly how they're affected by it.
Weatherhead uses the data and images from the unmanned aircraft to count populations of Arctic species to understand how the animals are adapting to polar warming. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Blood donation takes only 45 minutes and saves lives. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
Let's take a look at Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight. In the north and in central sections, cloudy with fog developing and patches of drizzle during the evening and some freezing drizzle overnight. In the south tonight, mostly cloudy with patchy fog and drizzle forming. Lows ranging from 23 in far northwestern Illinois to 33 in the south. Tomorrow, in northern Illinois, partly to mostly sunny. In northern Indiana and in central sections, mostly cloudy with patchy fog and freezing drizzle early. In the south, cloudy with patchy fog and drizzle. Highs ranging from 32 in northwestern Illinois to 44 in the far south. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with a chance of some drizzle during the evening hours and freezing drizzle and fog overnight. The low